Chapter 18. All India Religions Conference. The Dharma Parishad was one of the first of those inter-religious gatherings which, during the decade after independence, became such a feature of Indian cultural life. Under a huge pandal, or framework of bamboo poles covered with white cloth, between 2,000 and 3,000 people squatted from 10 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon each day, listening to the apparently interminable flow of lectures. On the platform, furnished with mattresses and bolsters instead of chairs, were crowded 4 or 5 dozen representatives of different religions and sects, as well as the organisers of the conference. Since most of the speeches were in Gujarati, of which I understood not a word, I spent the greater part of the first session looking about me. Practically all the delegates, it seemed, were Hindus. Christianity was represented by an English missionary who squatted uncomfortably, his pink face and sandy hair oddly conspicuous. Islam by a bearded Maulvi in a black coat. Near the microphone sat 2 or 3 Jain Munis, their white garments and the gauze masks they wore over mouth and nose, giving them a strangely surgical appearance. There was also a Zoroastrian from Bombay, his peculiarly convoluted cow's hoof headgear glittering with gold thread. Nowhere could I detect the familiar yellow robe. Buddhism, from the numerical point of view alone, one of the greatest of the world's religions, seemed to be most inadequately represented by the 21-year-old ex-soldier from the Mahabodhi Society. While I was speculating on the possible explanations for this meagre representation of all religions other than Hinduism, I was jerked back to awareness of the proceedings by the sound of my name booming from the loudspeakers. It was my turn to contribute to the flow. As I rose to my feet, a warning voice said, "Only 10 minutes." Another hissed vehemently in my ear, "Say that Buddhism and Hinduism are the same." Though next day I wrote out the substance of my speech for publication, it has now almost faded from memory. But I spoke for 20 minutes instead of 10, and I did not say that Buddhism and Hinduism were the same. While I was prepared in such a gathering to stress points of agreement rather than differences, I drew the line at echoing, even in the supposed interest of interreligious amity, an assertion that I thought false. Hinduism had yet to learn that tolerance is an acceptance of differences in religious conviction, rather than the forcible assimilation of one tradition to another. All over India, during the last 20 years, people knowing nothing of Buddhism, who never in their lives opened a Buddhist text, have told me with an air of authority, "Buddhism is the same as Hinduism." It may be, but uninformed insistence on the point betrays either a pathological basis or plain intellectual dishonesty. Despite the speaker's recalcitrance, the speech was well received, and when I sat down, the plump Gujarati organisers thumped me vigorously on the back and whispered words of congratulation. The rest of the day, indeed the rest of the week, was taken up by speeches in Gujarati and Hindi, most of them on Hinduism, and all more than an hour long. Once again I looked about me. The representatives of Hinduism were indeed a motley crowd. While a few were dressed in snowy white, some wore red, brown or orange garments. The predominant colour was the light salmon pink of the orthodox Vedantic ascetics. Most of the monks were shaven-headed, but several had allowed both hair and beard to grow to enormous length. Worshippers of Shiva were swathed in row upon row of giant brown Rudraksha beads and smeared with ashes. Devotees of Vishnu wore a single row of tiny white beads of sacred basil, while their foreheads were adorned with a variety of red, white, and yellow sectarian marks. Some looked brutal and belligerent. Others had features of striking refinement and intellectuality. Just in front of me sat three plump, silk-clad figures, who, from the multitude of their bangles and anklets, I at first took for women. However, they were followers of the Vallabha sect, male followers of which are required to emulate Radha, the mistress and principal devotee of Sri Krishna, not only in internal devotional attitude towards the incarnate Lord, but externally in dress and demeanour. One of its subsects goes so far as to practice castration. With representatives of so many rival sects on the platform, there had naturally been a fierce dispute for precedence. By general consent, this had in the end been conceded to His Holiness the Shankaracharya of Puri, incumbent of one of the four chief maths established by the great non-dualist philosopher Shankara, as the tradition to which His Holiness belonged was admittedly the most ancient. This dignitary therefore sat enthroned on a tiger-skin-draped dais to one side of the platform. A short, plump man of about 70, he sat motionless through the entire proceedings. His salmon-pink robe seemed to consist of a single piece of cloth, which was not only twisted about the body, but draped over the head. Forehead and arms were marked with ashes in three horizontal bars. Round his neck hung massive ropes of Rudraksha beads and a magnificent crystal rosary. More Rudraksha beads were wound about his head, apparently to keep the robe in place. His left hand supported a silver staff, round which was twisted a strip of salmon-pink cloth. Before him on a small table stood a pair of silver sandals, a silver phallus of the god Shiva, and the rest of his regalia. Whenever he entered or left the pandal, he was preceded by a master of ceremonies who shouted, "Jagat Guru Sri Shankaracharya Ji Ki Jai," or "Victory to the World Teacher, His Holiness the Shankaracharya," to which the crowd dutifully responded, "Jai," or "Victory." In the course of one of the sessions, however, His Holiness's dignity was sadly compromised. One of the speakers was a short, corpulent monk of rather unpleasant countenance. Though I understood nothing of his speech, which was in Gujarati, I could sense the displeasure of the crowd. Presently there were angry murmurs, then shouts. Later I was told that not far from the pandal, the corpulent monk had recently built a Gita temple. In it he had installed an image of the Bhagavad Gita in the form of a goddess with four arms. To worship this image, which of course meant paying money to the temple, was, according to him, equivalent to reading, understanding, and practicing the whole teaching of the sacred book it represented. Not everybody agreed that religion could be simplified in this way, and there had been strong opposition to the new temple. Apparently, the founder was now taking advantage of the parishad to attack his critics. So intemperate were his expressions that a section of the crowd, enraged, surged forward and tried to pluck him from the platform. His disciples sprang to the rescue. The microphone was overturned. In an instant, the platform was a battlefield. the little Shankaracharya skipped down from his throne with astonishing agility. The master of ceremonies hastily swept the regalia into a dirty cloth. Non-combatant delegates jumped to their feet. But as quickly as it had begun, the fracas subsided. His Holiness climbed back onto his throne. The regalia was again displayed. The delegates resumed their seats, and the cause of the disturbance concluded his speech on a more conciliatory note. The best-received address was given by a quite different type of person. He was an old, blind ascetic who was led forward to the microphone by a youthful disciple. Like most of the Orthodox Hindu delegates, he spoke sitting cross-legged. Despite his blindness, he spoke so impressively, and his rugged, unattractive presence radiated such power that a hush fell upon the audience. Like most Hindus, though they might for a time be deceived by the emotional and intellectual imitations of religion, they recognized the authentic utterance, the genuine ring of spiritual experience when they heard it. His speech ended. The blind ascetic followed his disciple out of the pandal, indifferent to the applause. Several of the delegates, including myself, had been accommodated in the classrooms of the local high school, then closed for these summer holidays. As the custom is in non-westernized Indian society, lunch was served at 9 o'clock, so that we could sit through the day's proceedings without a break until tea time. To this arrangement I could adapt myself. Indian food I was already accustomed to taking. What troubled me was the lack of a bathroom. The other delegates squatted one by one under a cold tap in the courtyard, changing from wet to dry clothes without any offence to decency. But my English reluctance to take a bath in public and the nature of my dress made it impossible for me to follow their example. After wrapping a dry sarong round the waist over the wet one, the latter can be allowed to slip to the ground. But one cannot follow this procedure with two pairs of trousers. Even when my roommate, a cheerful, expansive monk of early middle age, who, having mixed much with Europeans, understood their difficulties, came to my rescue with a spare piece of white cloth, I draped it so self-consciously that some of the delegates remarked, wonderingly, "He doesn't know how to take a bath." I realized that without giving up Western dress, full adaptation to the Indian way of life was impossible. The same cheerful monk lent me a brass water pot, for had I been seen going in the direction of the latrines without one, I might have been ostracized by the more orthodox delegates. He also attempted to constitute himself my guru. On the first evening of our acquaintance, he explained to me the new method of meditation he had discovered. Rather reluctantly, I allowed him to press his thumbs against my eyeballs until they hurt unbearably. "What do you see?" he demanded. "A lot of coloured lights," I replied truthfully. "Yes, it's the light of the self," he exclaimed triumphantly. "You must meditate on that." In the classroom opposite camped the Shankaracharya. Though at first fearful of approaching so august a personage, I eventually picked up enough courage to ask my roommate if he thought an audience could be arranged. He thought it could. In fact, he spoke himself to the Master of Ceremonies, and late the same evening I was ushered into the presence of His Holiness. By the flickering light of a single oil lamp, the small familiar figure looked far more impressive than in the glare of the crowded pandal. Peering through the semi-darkness, I could make out the tiger skin, the crystal rosary, and the silver staff of office. so exalted a personage was apparently never seen except in full regalia. I was given a seat immediately in front of the throne dais. We had not conversed for more than a few minutes when I discovered that, for all his apparent orthodoxy, His Holiness was a kindly, unpretentious person who could be liked as a man, quite apart from the respect due to him on account of his high religious office. Most of his life, he told me, had been spent as a chartered accountant in Madras. Only after retirement had he become a monk. At the end of the audience, which lasted half an hour, he gave me his card and invited me to correspond. In the course of the next few years, we not only exchanged a number of letters, but also met once again in circumstances of unusual interest.